We're starting, though, with a story in Vancouver where a couple says their rent is going up by, or it's being, they're being told it's going up by 20% because they've added a baby to their family.
Just because something is written into a contract doesn't mean it's legal or enforceable. And I believe that anyone who looked at this issue would see that it's preposterous. She's a baby. She's not a roommate. Like, we're starting a family. We're not trying to, like, game the system and have more paying adults than should be in our apartment. It's just not what the law was written for or how it's intended to be used, and it feels manipulative.
That's Victoria Walsh, and she was talking to Global News about what is happening and what the landlord has been telling them about the rent increase. Well, Zuzana Modrovic is a lawyer with the Tenant Resource and Advisory Center, and Zuzana joins us now to talk a bit more about this. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What are your thoughts on this? So she was talking to Global News about the fact that in the contract that they signed, the lease that they signed with their landlord, it does say if there are any more occupants that are added to, that are living in the apartment, that the rent can go up. They obviously didn't think of that being a child as expanding their family. But is this something that landlords can do?
Yeah, so the Residential Tenancy Act specifically allows landlords to raise the rent beyond the sort of rent increase limits when there's a term in the contract that allows them to do so for additional occupants being added. And then the Act and the regulation and the policy are all silent on what it actually means to be an additional occupant, like whether it's limited to adult additional occupants or whether it may include a baby. So the question of whether or not this is allowed is, I think, a live question. I'm not sure anyone can predict the answer or the outcome of a dispute resolution hearing, which is, my understanding, will happen in this case. That will depend on sort of the specifics of the term in the contract itself, my understanding. So a tenant in this situation can argue that the term is not enforceable, either because it's unconscionable under the Act, which just means it's grossly unfair to one party, or if it's too vague. So, for example, if the term doesn't actually specify how much the rent is going up by, there's a reasonable argument to be made that at the time of the contract was signed, that term was too vague to be enforceable. The landlord can't simply just make up a number when it's time to rely on the term.
And I know the housing minister was asked about this, and he hinted or suggested that maybe there would be some changes to the definition of this, or maybe if it's that, yes, there's another tenant that's added to whoever's living in the suite, but maybe there would be a way for the wording so that it would exempt somebody if they had a baby, and that's how mm-hmm. it was added. Does it seem, though, I mean, if the landlord is just looking at this in that if the agreement they have, it says another person is in the suite, then would that be the argument that the contract says another person and now there's another person here?
I think that's probably what the landlord would argue in this case. But again, the tenant can argue that the term is itself not enforceable because it's grossly unfair. Or at least the way it's being interpreted by the landlord is grossly unfair, because the landlord seems to be interpreting that to mean that a newborn baby will result in this kind of rent increase. So just because it's written in the contract doesn't mean it's going to be enforceable if there's a dispute about it.
Right. And I mean, I guess if you're trying to look at this from a reasonable sense, the idea of having this would be if another adult moved in, then maybe there would be more wear and tear on the unit. Maybe if it includes things like, say, heat and hot water, maybe another adult would add to that and it would make it more expensive for the landlord. And is that why we would generally see these types of clauses or this language in a lease agreement?
Yes, I think that's sort of the common sense understanding of why that's something that the Residential Tenancy Act allows for at all. Like, there has to be a reason why the Act allows landlords to include these terms in tenancy agreements. And I think the most sensible approach to interpreting that is that what the Act is trying to allow for is increased costs, and wear and tear on a unit where there are more adults or more occupants.
And is it difficult to, in this type of rental environment where it can be very challenging to find housing, it can be very challenging to find housing that is affordable for a lot of people, that even if that's written into the lease agreement or it's in the contract, even if you're a little bit wary perhaps of signing that, that people would sign it anyway?
Oh, yeah.
Because otherwise,
absolutely.
Where are you going to live?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we see quite a bit of that where people sign on to tenancy agreements where with questionable terms or terms they would normally not want to agree to, but simply because they can't find anything else, they sign these kinds of contracts. So, yes, that's absolutely, this is absolutely a result of the housing crisis, or one of the results of the housing crisis, is that people in this position can't move. Like, in a healthy housing market with a healthy vacancy rate, a person whose landlord is pressuring them to increase the rent by this much might have the option to pick up and go somewhere else. In this housing market, those options are limited to non-existent. So yes, it definitely exacerbates this kind of problem.
And when we are looking at that number too, where she said that the landlord is saying that the rent is going to go up another 20% because of this, is that something that, like you said, so this is a scenario where in the lease agreement or in the contract, there is this clause based on more tenants joining and living in the apartment. If that is in your contract, can it be any amount as far as the landlord is saying for every additional tenant, it's going to be this much? And is that up to the discretion of the landlord to make that or to come up with that number?
Just, I would certainly argue that if the number is not specified in the tenancy agreement itself, then the term is unenforceable because it's too vague to be enforceable. That wouldn't be what I would argue if it's not specified in the contract. If it is specified in the contract, then yes, it can be any number that the parties agree on. And again, that agreement is sort of predicated on the idea that the contracting parties are on equal footing, which, of course, in this sort of housing market is absolutely not the case.
So what advice maybe is there for people that are signing these types of lease agreements or contracts as far as knowing what's okay to be in there, what's legal and what's not?
I mean, in generally, any sort of term that is grossly one-sided, so significantly unfair to one party or the other, can be argued to be unconscionable. Any term that is too vague to know what it truly means, you can also argue is not enforceable. And there's sort of all kinds of ways you can argue something is unenforceable. For example, also if it contradicts something in the Residential Tenancy Act, it may also be unenforceable for that reason. So I think the best advice is if someone isn't sure and if they have an option of whether or not to sign the agreement is to reach out and seek information, legal information. We have an information line. Our website exists. The RTB itself, the Residential Tenancy Branch, has an information line and also they have lots of information on their website about what kinds of terms are and are not allowed. So doing research before signing something is generally a good idea.
Have you seen cases like this before when an addition to a family has led to a landlord saying, okay, the rent's going to go up?
Yes, yes. And in my experience, which is limited, I've only sort of done a cursory look at past decisions, arbitrators have decided both ways, that sometimes it's okay and sometimes it's not.
All right. So, well, like you said, they are going to be taking it to the residential tenancy, to the tenancy branch coming up in June. So we'll see what happens with that. Zuzana, thank you so much. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you very much as well. It was a pleasure.
Well, there is some good news and potentially some bad news when we are talking about Chinook and a potential Chinook fishery off the mouth of the Fraser River. According to Pacific Angler, the numbers from last year's Chinook returns are good, but there are concerns that the DFO could shut down areas where they're hoping to have fisheries. Well, joining us to talk about that more is Jason Tonelli, the owner of Pacific Angler. Jason, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Jill. It's great to be back on the show.
Yeah, we haven't talked in a while, but I'm glad you're able to come back and talk about this today because you have put this out there and making sure that people are aware of this, saying that the Chinook fishery off the mouth of the Fraser River, potentially in September, is in jeopardy. So what's happening?
Yeah, so what we have happening here is last year DFO did put some southern resident Killawell sanctuary zones off the north arm of the Fraser, which pretty much cut the available fishery area in half. There is a proposal out there right now where they'd like to potentially extend that zone all the way down to the south arm of the Fraser. Last year, the closure was till October 1st, and they're looking to push that out to October 31st. So if that goes through, you're basically looking at the whole mouth of the Fraser being closed to salmon fishing August 1st to October 31st. So there would be a large closed area where you would not be able to fish for salmon because they would have it closed to aid southern resident killer whale foraging.
And what would that do to your industry or to the sport fishing industry?
Well, it's a huge fishery. The mouth of the Fraser is the main access point for all people from Vancouver all the way out to the lower mainland, and also people coming up from the United States and really people from all over the world. It's the last major Chinook or salmon fishery on years of abundance for sockeye and pink that we have left in Vancouver. It would devastate local businesses that rely on it, like fishing tackle stores, fishing guides, and it would cost the local economy millions and millions of dollars, without a doubt.
And so when we're talking about the southern resident killer whales, though, has the DFO given a reason as to why that protected area is, there's the potential of it being expanded, or what are your thoughts on looking at that as to why we're seeing a bigger area?
Well, this is the thing. They actually don't have the data that shows how often the southern resident killer whales are off the mouth of the Fraser. So the people that are experts at this, like local fishing guides like myself, we're there for thousands and thousands of hours over decades. The whales do come into the area, but they're literally there for hours. They're not there for half a day or even a day. They might not be there for weeks on end. So these large-scale static closure zones are a really ineffective way to manage southern resident killer whale presence. In fact, some of the other scientists out there, like the Orca Behavior Institute, are actually advocating for more dynamic approaches. So we really want DFO to take a look at this, and they need to have management that correlates to the actual presence and actual risk that southern resident killer whales might face from angling activity. So when they come into the area for a couple of hours, we're really looking for DFO to implement a 1,000-meter avoidance zone. This is likely going to be consistent with an approach in Washington State as well.
And when you talk about the risk to southern resident killer whales and the reasoning given, again, by DFO, is it because they're concerned that fisheries will mean not as much salmon for the whales, or are they concerned about interactions with boats?
Well, they are primarily concerned with interactions with boats. Recent studies have shown that boats that are fishing, so very, very low rate of speed, maybe a mile an hour when you're trolling, as the whales are approaching those boats, we don't have much impact. Boats that are approaching whales at a high rate of speed are shown to have more impact. So fishing boats in general aren't going to have a large impact, especially if we have a 1,000-meter avoidance zone and we can get out of the area in advance. And when it comes to the number of salmon, recent studies have also shown that there's 11 to 22 times the necessary Chinook in the U.S. and Canadian waters to satisfy the nutritional requirements of the whales. So there's some conflicting data out there.
And I would think, too, and for anyone that's been out fishing, you would know, too, if it's not an issue of the number of fish, if you're out fishing and you see killer whales, it's not like you're going to stick around and be close to them. I mean, you might take a look, but the fish don't exactly bite so much when there's whales swimming around and there's predators in the water, do they?
That's exactly right. When the whales come through, generally, the Chinook often disperse and the anglers disperse with it. So it's not uncommon when the killer whales do come through off the mouth of the Fraser, people's cell phones start going off, people are on the radio, hey, the whales are coming. We're experts. We know where they come from. They're coming from the Tawasin area up off the south arm to the north arm. And usually by the time the whales get into the area, we're gone. We know they're coming. We want to get out of their way, and we know that fishing is going to be slow. It should also be noted that DFO also already has the vast majority of the high-use southern resident killer whale area off the Fraser closed. It's been closed for years, right off the Tawasin ferry terminal, an area called Coalports, up into the south arm, and then right off the flats of the south arm up to the north arm. It's all closed for salmon fishing. Has been for years. DFO's own heat map of occurrence of use shows that that's the primary area, and we would like to that area to remain closed. It works for the whales, and it works for us.
You've sent out as well a couple of maps with the area you were just referencing by the ferry terminal kind of in that area, and then with the potential, the option two, which would see the much bigger area, and as well saying that your concerns are that they're leaning towards option two. What makes you think that?
Well, I was in a meeting for 3 hours yesterday with DFO and Transport Canada, and I've been in many meetings for many years. So you do pick up a bit of a vibe on these meetings. And some of the verbiage that DFO used, they said, you know, we don't feel that the current option one closure off the north arm is providing enough protection for the southern resident killer whales, hence the need for them to come up with option two. So it was just my personal opinion that I think that they are taking a hard look at that option. I don't think it's the right way to go. I think that an avoidance of zone of 1,000 meters would be much more effective, and it would be a balance. This is all about balance. When the whales are there, we're happy to leave. The reality is they don't have the data to make such massive closures that are going to have huge social, economic, and impact. They just don't have the data. We do. We're there. We've been there for decades. We've been there for years, and we know that 90%+ of the time, the whales just aren't there. So to have these big, huge interim sanctuary zones for months on end just makes absolutely no sense and will have a huge social and economic impact.
And Jason, I wanted to ask you as well, because you've also included some of the Chinook numbers, and again, saying that the numbers look really promising, the numbers are good. Do you think, should that change anything as far as sport fishing or openings or access to Chinook, or is that, has that part already been dealt with?
Well, there are current Fraser River Chinook regulations in place to protect a lot of those fish that I showed graphs of in the post that I put out on the Pacific Angler blog. What I wanted to show is that a lot of those runs were coming off of some very, very low and sometimes record low broodstock years. And the runs have gone up considerably. So that's promising. One year is not a trend. I don't expect DFO to make any management decisions based on that for 23-24. But as those numbers continue to grow, I do believe that DFO will work with the advisory board, the Sports Fish Advisory Board, to look at potential openings. There's been some huge closures because of those low numbers, but it's great to see those numbers increasing, and I think that DFO will be positively reacting in the future. The reason I wanted to show that is because although that might be happening, outside of that, if we have these large southern resident killer whale closures, you won't have access to those fish. We saw some great fishing off the Fraser mouth last September for Chinook stocks of non-concern, and we definitely need that access again in 2023.
You were asking people as well to provide feedback. What are you hoping, or what are you asking people who are concerned about this to do?
What we're asking people to do is to contact DFO via the survey that they've given, or even better, write a letter. And the link to that survey and where you can email letters is on the Pacific Angler blog. Let them know how important this fishery is to you. This fishery has huge participation. This is the last major Chinook fishery for sustainable Chinook in basically the whole Vancouver area. And the window that was given to reply to these closures was quite narrow. Everyone's busy these days, so we just wanted to get the word out there. We want to get people to reply and let DFO and Transport Canada know how important this fishery is to them.
All right. Well, Jason, thank you so much for coming on the show and for talking more about this today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for the time, Jill. Always a pleasure.
Well, certainly things have changed a lot over the past few years. And if we go back, how far do you think we have to go back to a time when spanking was not only the norm, but it may have been encouraged as a form of discipline? If we go back even further, there are probably people who can remember getting a ruler across the hand at school for acting out, maybe something even worse. Well, things have changed, and perhaps that is one of the things that has changed for the better, in that that is no longer allowed. But how do Canadians feel about any kind of physical discipline when it comes to children? Well, Mario Canseco, the president of Research Co., is joining us now because he has done some research on that, and he's here to share the numbers with us. Mario, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure, Jill. Great to be here with you.
This is an interesting one because there really has been a shift, I think, but there is still, I'm guessing, some out there with the school of thought that think some level of this is okay. So what did you find?
Well, I think one of the biggest confusions that we have is that it's the same section of the criminal code that allows the use of, quote, reasonable force on children for parents and school teachers. And what we see here is a situation where Canadians are not reacting very positively to the fact that school teachers can be allowed to use reasonable force on a child. And if we go back, this is one of the remnants of the 1892 criminal code. So we have to go back a couple of centuries to figure out why this is in there. And it hasn't been changed. There is right now a bill in the House of Commons that has been proposed by the MP from New Westminster, Peter Julian. He's from the NDP. To essentially abolish this section of the criminal code. And more than half of Canadians believe that this is the right course of action.
Right. So the section of the code, and you've put this in your information about this as well, saying that every school teacher, parent, or person standing in the place of a parent is justified in using force by way of correction toward a pupil or child, as the case may be, who is under his care, if the force does not exceed what is reasonable under the circumstances. I mean, even that for a part of the criminal code is extremely vague.
It's a bit of a handful, isn't it? And you know, part of the problem with this is it leads any person to define what is reasonable for them. So we don't really have a situation where there's a specific thing that can be done, whether you're doing it in a specific setting, whether you're using something to essentially have that reasonable force applied to a child. So this is part of the problem that we have. We have a section of the criminal code that doesn't make a difference between school teachers and parents, number one, but also that doesn't explain what reasonable force is. And we've seen other countries over the past 20, 30 years abolishing all sorts of corporal punishment for children, whether it happens in the home or at school. So Canada is one of the last remaining nations that still has a law in the books, and it's a law that was written in the 19th century.
And so what did you find then? Because you asked Canadians, and a bit of a difference as far as the percentages of people saying that they would support repealing Section 43, that section that I just read, repealing that from the code. What did you find?
Well, there are some intriguing differences across regions. Quebec is definitely at the top. 61% of Quebecers who say that we should abolish this legislation. BC came in second place at 50%, followed by Alberta and Ontario at 49%. So there's a high level of support in some parts of the country. What is really interesting here is the changes from generations. The youngest Canadians, aged 18 to 34, support this at 61%, middle age bracket 53%, but dropping to 42% with those over the age of 55, who, by the way, are more likely to report that they face this type of punishment at home or at school.
Which isn't a huge surprise, because I think that it was, if you go to that age group, and when that age group was young, when they were small children, spanking was nobody thought spanking was wrong, really. It was something that was done, and that was a preferred or accepted form of punishment.
It was. We can see it in the numbers. 67% of Canadians aged 55 and over saying that a parent or guardian physically discipline them. Similar numbers for the middle age bracket at 65%, but you see the changes with the younger generation. Only 47% who say that they had this experience at home, and also a big drop when it comes to schools relying on this type of way of keeping things disciplined. So younger generations more likely to not have experienced this, and also more likely to think that it's appalling that we have this in the criminal code. the older generation not as convinced.
What did you find as well with, because the fact that it puts parents and school teachers on the same level, but I know you asked people about allowing parents to physically discipline children and as well allowing school teachers to physically discipline children. And what did you find there?
Well, this is the biggest discrepancy in the entire survey, because we have 58% of Canadians who agree that parents should be allowed to physically discipline their children. But the level of support drops to 26% when it comes to school teachers. So we're clearly establishing a difference here between what is acceptable and what is not. And this is what makes the repeal of Section 43 so complicated. It's not a proposal to remove school teachers from this and only allow children to be physically disciplined by their parents or guardians. You need to repeal the entire section for this to make sense. And we still see a significant number of Canadians who want to keep that opportunity, but only for the parents, not for the school teachers.
Did you ask people, and I suppose too, you'd have to be completely honest about this, and maybe people might not be, but did you ask people if they personally physically disciplined their children or if they had been?
We didn't ask them this time around. I think it's an important issue now that we've realized that the major generational differences here. I think it's something that I am curious for the next available opportunity, because we do see that there's fewer Canadians who experience this. But what would be interesting to know for the next one is how many are doing that to their own children or did it in the past.
Anything else stick out to you that was surprising or as far as the numbers go?
Well, it's definitely a big change. We asked this question back in 2018, and at the time we had significantly larger proportions of Canadians who thought that we shouldn't be messing with the criminal code. I think part of what's happened over the past 5 years is people learn more about how kids grow up and the types of discipline that are effective. What I find bizarre about this is we are dealing with a piece of legislation that was written just a few years after the invention of the typewriter, at a time when we have so much information available online on how to discipline children, how to treat them, what is making them different from other generations. So maybe it's time for the criminal code to come into the 21st century. Most Canadians would want it that way.
Yeah, it seems like it definitely in these findings. Mario, thank you so much for joining us and for bringing us this information. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jill. Anytime.
As you've been hearing on the news, we have more information about the public inquiry into the so-called Freedom Convoy and the use of the Emergencies Act. We heard earlier today from the justice who was leading that inquiry.
After careful reflection, I have concluded that the very high threshold required for the invocation of the act was met. In particular, for reasons that I discuss in detail in the report, I have concluded that when the decision was made to invoke the Act on February 14th, 2022, Cabinet had reasonable grounds to believe that there existed a national emergency arising from threats to the security of Canada that necessitated the taking of special temporary measures.
That was Justice Paul Rouleau speaking earlier today. Well, joining us now to talk more about this is Associate Professor at the Peter A. Allard School of Law at UBC, Jocelyn Stacey. And Jocelyn Stacey also served on the Commission's Research Council. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What are your thoughts on the report being released and the findings in that report?
I think that this is actually a really comprehensive report and quite impressive given the enormous task that the Commission faced and really heading out into uncharted territory investigating the first ever use of the Emergencies Act. And I guess what I'm struck by is the fact that the Commissioner reached this conclusion that, you know, although the federal government's use of the Act in this case was justified, that this was not, you know, this he came to this conclusion reluctantly and that the evidence wasn't overwhelming. So I take from this that this is not at all an endorsement of the use of emergency powers, that it's quite a sort of a careful conclusion that in this case, you know, it was necessary, but it should have never come to this.
What about some of the criticism or some of the questions around looking at the different protests, not only the protest in Ottawa, but looking, say, at the protest in Alberta and some of the places where effectively they had been taken down when the Emergencies Act was invoked? And that was one of the arguments, or one of the questions at least, about whether or not it was a national emergency. Did this inquiry address that?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it is important to keep in mind the fact that with the Federal Emergencies Act, the definition for invoking emergency powers really does require this this national dimension to it. And so the commissioner, you know, I'm still working my way through the report, but I can see from the work that the commissioner has done here is that, you know, he is pulling from these examples all across the country to show where they're were threats, you know, that there were threats of serious violence, and that those had to be taken seriously by the federal government. And it was happening in a way where, even though, you know, the timing of the events was such that some of these had been resolved, that it wasn't like the situation across the country was under control by any extent. And so, you know, his report really sort of takes into account the sort of global or national scale of the information that was being provided to Cabinet at that moment in time.
Does it also talk about, and I know it's fresh out, and I think it's about 270 pages, so I know that you're still looking at it and people are still going through the finer points of the report, but does it look at as well the use of the Emergencies Act and in invoking it? Because I know there were also questions about freezing of funds and donations that may have been made to some of those participating, and a lot of questions there about potential government overreach.
Yeah, that's right. And so what the commissioner does is, you know, he is tasked with looking at a number of things. And so his conclusions on the use of the Emergencies Act are both with respect to that first decision to invoke the act and then the actual measures that were used. And so that is right. He comes out with some findings about the particular measures that were used. And while some of them he finds were effective, he points out the ways in which these were overbroad and in some ways vague. And in particular, he is concerned about the financial measures in particular, not having protections in place for people to, unfreeze their funds once they've sort of stopped engaging in the prohibited activity. And he looks at the measures that were in place that restricted entry into certain places and comments on the fact that that would have, you know, that he had concerns about its impacts on, in particular, freedom of the press. So he is scrutinizing this very carefully. Like I said, this is not at all an endorsement of the use of emergency powers. It is, you know, pointing out that that there were very real concerns here and that there are important lessons that have been learned that need to be carried forward.
Does he also look at it or mention or look into how it got to be, got to the point where the government invoked the Emergencies Act, that could have been avoided if, say, police had done more, if more had been done in the beginning to keep it from getting to that point?
Yeah, that's right. This is a huge focus of his report, and I'm not a policing expert, but what I can tell you is that the commissioner in his statement this morning was very clear that there were a number of missteps and failures on the part of police that allowed the events to get to this stage. Oh, half of his recommendations in the report are dedicated to policing, so there's obviously a lot of work that needs to be done in this sphere.
And so with the recommendations, and like you said, this isn't just letting the federal government off the hook. It's not an endorsement of bringing in the act, but does say that they met the threshold. Are the recommendations then to avoid this happening in the future, or what is the focus, your take on the focus of those recommendations?
That's right. So there are sort of a few categories of recommendations here. A number of them, as I've said, go to policing. And so really in a preventative way, right, trying to adapt policing and overall coordination between governments and agencies to ensure that the right to protest, right, is the right to protest lawfully is protected, right, and that that's a role of policing, but that police can also be effective at stepping in when things veer into unlawful territory. There are a number of recommendations as well that go to reforming the Emergencies Act moving forward. Some of them go to this questions around what is a public order emergency, and a lot of the confusion in this case or in this instance was because this definition is kind of nebulous, right? And so the commissioner recommends that Parliament do a comprehensive study to figure out, you know, what are legitimate public order, public threats in this day and age, keeping in mind that the Act is from the 1980s. What are the kinds of measures, you know, that government will need if we have a legitimate threat that rises to the level of a national emergency? And how can we maintain that high threshold while taking into account the way in which public order events have changed over this period of time? So that's going to be very important to watch going forward. And I'll just note there's sort of another category of recommendations, I think, that go to really ensuring accountability for future governments. So, in this case, the federal government did participate fully in the public inquiries process. And so making sure that things like that are embedded as requirements in the Act in case it needs to be invoked again.
And I thought it was interesting, too, because while this was happening, there was also a lot of disagreement on who it was that was, if we look specifically at the Ottawa protests, who it was that was protesting. It seemed very different during the day than perhaps at night. And we were hearing from people who said actually during the day, it felt like Canada Day. People were gathering, there were families, but and then a much different feel at night. And I know he addresses whether or not these protests were peaceful or they were unsafe and chaotic, and did, I think, find that Ottawa was unsafe. Was that one of his findings?
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, he acknowledges that protests are messy and that many of the protesters, most of the protesters, in fact, that were involved came with the intention of exercising their rights, of lawful protest, but that things at some point crossed over and got out of control. And he makes a number of findings around the role of the organizers in that. And, while they weren't sort of couldn't be responsible for everybody, but that there was really an acknowledgement that there was, you know, that there was harassment happening and that Ottawa residents were, felt unsafe as a result of the activities.
And this report has taken many, many months to get to this point. And like you said, this is kind of also for future governments if something like this is to happen. But do you think it will work as that or kind of like a template then as far? And I mean, hopefully we're not going to be in a scenario where there's the potential for the Emergencies Act. But is that kind of the purpose of this?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I think the thing about emergencies, though, is that each one is kind of different, right? And so there are a number of things that we're going to learn from this, and hopefully a number of these recommendations are taken forward and put into effect. But, you know, we live in an era of the climate crisis, and, you know, we're sort of it feels like, you know, that we're being presented with different kinds of emergencies all the time. So, you know, we do need to make sure that our Emergencies Act is up to date to take into account, the era that we now live in.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jocelyn Stacey. Thank you for joining us and for talking about the findings. Again, I know it's a lengthy report, so thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.